we're talking about conservative agenda in halakha, and something we said is intensified for a variety of reasons, which we really didn't go into very much. Some of the major figures moving in that direction are the Chatam Sofer, which we will discuss a little bit more today, the Mishnah Berurah, the Chafetz Chaim, right, and the Chazon Ish. These are some of the three great pillars of this trend, and it's a trend that's, as I said, really taken off in the last 30, 40 years. Rabbi Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik speaks about the fact that people knew about Shiurim that Chazon Ish spoke about well before the Chazon Ish came along, and for some reason he writes in his article, his famous article that we always speak about, that the Shiurim didn't actually take off. The people were worried for the larger Shiurim of the Chazon Ish till about the 1960s, 1970s. So that agenda has taken off. It's an agenda that, we said, tries to defend tradition, tries to put tradition on a pedestal, because we live in such shaky times in terms of modernity, when there's so much that's brought up for question. So specifically to try to hold all questions at bay by essentially denying the value of novelty per se, not completely saying that we can never, even the Chatam Sofer doesn't take Hadash Asur Min HaTorah literally, in the sense that any novelty is completely pasul. But on some level, to suspect anything that's novel and to make it, the onus of proof is on novelty and not on tradition. In other words, the question is, what's the default and what has to prove its way in? So in the conservative agenda, the default is tradition, and what's to prove itself is novelty, is something new. What we're going to do today is to look at some of the possible directions that any meta-halachic strategy has to work within. We suggested that, given the nature of the conservative agenda, there has to be a certain denial of truth. We call it censorship, right? And we said that such a thing is not necessarily considered as negative, certainly not in any classical tradition, not in classical Judaism. And we said even today, the idea that you can censor information for the benefit of the person who is being fooled, so to speak, is something, is masa becholyom, right? The idea of paternalism, as much as it has a bad name in certain central philosophical, modern philosophical traditions, is something that's widespread nonetheless. So that in and of itself is not a psul. We said today we're going to speak more about its effectiveness. But before we do that, I want to backtrack. Again, being given the luxury of an extra class, I want to backtrack a little bit and go to the possible strategies. I threw at you an article today, those of you who had email access about 6 hours ago. I didn't expect you to read the full 112 pages that I sent you. That's why, although if you did, you deserve a medal. It's good reading when you have the time. It's helpful to discussion because it's going to illustrate what I'm going to be speaking about. So there are different strategies if you have a meta-halachic agenda. Now, we've seen very moderate meta-halachic. I mean, with putting the women's aliyah question aside, there's some of the other historical agendas that we saw, especially those of you who read Rabbi Sperber's article, different issues that came up historically. We spoke about poskim pushing different things off for the sake of chesed, for the sake of hefsed mamon, different issues that came up in halacha. That, according to Rabbi Sperber, I think correctly so, is an issue of a meta-halachic agenda, of certain values that are larger than specific halachic details come into play and overwhelm the minutiae of halacha. Now, the question is, meta halacha comes on a spectrum. There is a small m meta halacha, and there's large m meta halacha. Now, there was this whole spectrum of when do certain values trump normative halacha, ranging from things that are very, very small things, are hardly perceivable, to areas that are so radical that it are hard for anyone in the halachic system to accept. In any case, even let me introduce the article. Aryeh and Dov Frimmer, two brothers, and neither of which are practicing rabbis, both of which are ordained rabbis. I think both were ordained at Yeshiva University, if I'm not mistaken. Dov Frimmer is a lawyer. In fact, he once spoke for us. And they're both tremendous Talmid Chachamim. Aryeh Frimmer is a chemist at Bar Ilan. And Frimmer has been working for many, many years on women's issues in halacha. And the article I sent you is really his masterwork. He brought in his brother to work with him on this particular piece about the question, not this time of women's aliyot, but women's minyanim. And that has a certain history also. I'm not sure. I was at YU the time that this famous or infamous tshuva came out of I think it was called the Reitz 5 at that point. Reitz is the initials. Anybody know what the initials for? You obviously know because you're part of it. What was it? Right. That's the official English name of the yeshiva part of YU, Yeshiva University. I don't know why they're referred to as the Reitz Russia yeshiva in this particular case, but be that as it may, it's not really important. I think it was 1983. The question of women's minyanim came to a fore. It's not the first time it had come up, but it came to a fore and was presented to five of the senior rabbis at Yeshiva University for their opinion, and they came out very strongly against the idea of women's minyanim. Citing all sorts of issues. If you saw the article, the Frimmer rabbis and the Frimmer brothers go one by one, explain all the different issues that these rabbis brought against the idea of women's minyanim. And it was very contested at the time. People wrote against it. There was a lot of discussion about it. This major article against, Aryeh Frimmer already wrote an article against this few years after, it was already, I think, 8-10 years after in tradition, and then he wrote a much longer piece together with his brother, which is what I sent you in 1998, so it's almost, was that 15 years? Right, was that 16 years? 15 years, right? 15 years after, 83 to 98 is 15 years, right? Yeah? So, in any case, I don't know what the gematria is, but it's 15 years. In any case, the Frimmer brothers put out this major article, which you saw, giving all the sources that could be imaginable about this topic, all the various positions. What the Frimmers say, which had been said already very shortly after the tshuva came out, was that a lot of it was just a smokescreen. Meaning that the reasons given under halakha, such as ziyuf haTorah, for example, forging, falsifying the Torah. What else were some of the ta'anot of the Rosh Yeshiva that they made? Maybe remember anybody see it? The parts getter could have been one, but in any case, regardless of what they were, the point of the Frimmers was that essentially none of these arguments had any serious halachic weight. Whether that's true or not, obviously, is a matter of opinion, and I don't think any of the authors did or would admit that that is the case. But in any case, we're going to take it from the perspective for illustration's sake. We're not whether it's true or not is really, again, it's not really my argument, it's not my discussion. We can use it as a way to illustrate what rabbis can do if they see something as dangerous. In other words, it's clear that the rabbis in question saw this issue of women's minyanim as something that is dangerous for the Jewish people. In the Ephraimah article, he points out that Rabbi Soloveitchik also felt that it was a bad thing for the Jewish people. Okay? The question is, what do you do about it? If something is bad for the Jewish people, so the least offensive, I mean, there are three strategies. The least offensive is to see what the halacha has to say and hope that the halacha will come out in such a way as what that which you wish. In the article, if you have read or you will read it, there are three basic positions that are outlined. What he calls the pro, the anti, and the middle. Basically, I think he calls lenient, stringent, middle. Those are the terms that he uses. And he feels that both the lenient and middle opinions are legitimate halachic opinions. That's a legitimate debate. And the middle position, he cites people such as Rev Moshe Feinstein, Rev Avram Shapiro of Merkaz Arav, the English Beit Din. He cites the former chief rabbi of England as the primary mover at that time, as a middle position, meaning that they were able to look at the sources and see that within the sources there were some problems with women's minyanim, and simply present it as it is, with sort of pushing the halacha as far as it can legitimately go, but no further. In other words, there's an agenda, there's halachic basis for the agenda, and pushing the halacha as far as, or pushing the agenda, I should say, as far as normative halacha will take it. That's one approach. One approach is simply to look through the sources and use the sources in an honest way that incorporates your meta halachic sense. Right? As Rabbi Lichtenstein, we saw Rabbi Lichtenstein's article, and we'll get a chance to discuss it perhaps more. A post-it is allowed to use, at least from his perspective, his subjective sensitivities, as long as he's aware of where it's coming from. Okay, so that's one way of going about things. The second two ways are what is represented, again, from the Frimer article by the rabbis at YU on the one hand, and Rabbi Soloveitchik on the other. So one way is to do what Rabbi Soloveitchik did, and that's simply to be honest and say the halakha does not forbid it, but I think it should not be done. Right? That's model number two. Model number two is to say there's nothing in halakha about it, or there's nothing convincing, and there's no real hachra, there's no real definitive stance about this issue in halakha. Nonetheless, based on my knowledge and understanding of the larger picture, I recommend it not be done. Okay, that's approach number two of what you can do with the meta-halachic large M agenda. Possibility number three is to take a paternalistic approach, like we spoke about last week, and to pretend that the sources support your position. Right? This obviously has certain negative connotations, but we said, as we said before, if you're doing it for the benefit of the tzibur, then certainly it's something with precedent, and certainly it's something that, if it's effective, in the context of classical Judaism, is certainly legitimate. What I want to do is just look at each one of these options and see what the disadvantages are are. In other words, again, if you're Rabbi Soloveitchik or whoever you are, you're against women's minyanim, you can take three approaches, right? Assuming, again, we're taking the Frimer approach, that basically the halakha lies somewhere between the lenient and the middle position, meaning that at best there are some problems, but not with women's minyanim, but nothing that can't be somehow worked around. Right? That's basically, and as we're going to assume, whether that's true or not is not really important. We're just using it for an example. Let's assume that's the case. Okay? So now you have three possibilities. If you're against women's minyanim, you think that that's a bad thing for the Jewish people. Again, why it is, whether it's not, our discussion right now. But if you're in that chair, so you have three options, as we mentioned before. Option number one, see what the halacha has to say, push it as far as it's going to go, but no further. Option number two, pretend the halacha says what it doesn't in order to prove your agenda. Option number three is to withhold from giving a halachic presentation, but simply giving advice based on your vision of the wider scene. So let's take that approach first. Let's go backwards. And take, which we saw, again, if any of you read the article, which was Rabbi Soloveitchik's approach. The advantage is obvious. The advantage is you're being intellectually honest, right? Your integrity, you get integrity prize. What's a disadvantage? Why not do that? Yeah.
Well, people will say, oh, it's not there. I'm going to do it. Pretty much it.
Okay. In other words, you want to say something?
I mean, just because if you don't have a basis in the source of what you're saying, then unless people really, really respect you, it's a trouble to do.
Right. I mean, that's a good point, what you're saying. Basically, the only authority you have is that respect that people have for you. Essentially what we're talking about, the real problem is authority. In other words, you're choosing not to invoke your authority. If you're not invoking your authority, you're giving people the choice. If you're giving people the choice, you're taking back the possible control. As you have the ability with either two other options to control the situation to a greater extent, ostensibly. Well, as you mentioned, in other words, if you say it's mutar, but people are going to say, okay, it's mutar, and see you later. Whereas if you say it's asur, right, ostensibly, you have control over the people listening. I'm looking for the disadvantage. We have time, but not enough time to spend half an hour on each one of these possibilities. Yeah.
It's called a slippery slope as well. You start there and it's slippery, so you may slide down to another level. You see, you start doing what's right in your own eyes.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure if the approach lends itself to that. I think the issues and the law, the conservative agenda is very much worried about the slippery slope, and I think Rabbi Soloveitchik, Rabbi Feinstein, all these people were, specifically in the areas of women's minyanim, were very worried about the slippery slope. But I don't think that the approach per se of saying the sources don't say anything about it, but I recommend against it is necessarily something that's going to lead to a slippery slope. Yeah.
I think the problem is that people looking at such a statement would say that the rabbis had an agenda in addition to Allah, which becomes very problematic.
Okay.
They do, but then you're saying basically that the rabbis are manipulating us into their own agenda, and this is not an intrinsic. Well, they don't really have to do it.
Right. The question is,
but it could be dangerous.
Right. The question is, how do you look at? Right. That's the question. What is the position of rabbinic leadership? In other words, are the rabbis allowed to have the power, the authority? I was going to leave for it later, but there's a very interesting little prayer, the Frimmers present at the end of the article. Again, it's not on page 112 because there's the paper, which is about 40 pages. Then there's the addenda, which are very interesting, by the way. It's very useful in terms of our discussion. There's the footnotes. But in any case, around page 40, wherever it is, there's this prayer where they pray as following. We pray that our Torah leadership will be blessed with divine guidance, inspiration, and Solomonic wisdom to find the appropriate answers for our generation. But what I want to point out to you is the next part of the prayer. When we pray as well that the community will allow itself to be led, we're talking about leadership before. And we'll speak more about this in the second half of class, but that's in 5 minutes from now, so I don't know. We'll speak more about how community relates to religious leadership, b'sman hazeh. But anyways, let's go to the next strategy of dishonesty. And we said last week we spoke about Gemara and Beitza, right? Halacha vein morinken, which is interesting because in the Frimmer article they very much put it on the side. They try to marginalize. I mean, there's definitely a halachic agenda with all the massive sources that they give. There's definitely a halachic agenda that they're pursuing as well, consciously or unconsciously, I don't know. But they marginalize things that don't necessarily speak in their favor. But let's, putting that to the side, the paternalistic approach that we saw in the Gemara and Beitza, where both Rava and Avai were asked why they were doing an act that looked like they were sharpening the knives. The interlocutor in both cases would ask them, we give them two choices. Are you doing to wipe off the fat, or are you doing to sharpen it? And in both cases, Abaye and Rava both answer, we're doing it to wipe off the fat, right? Even though, and the Gemara continues, that in fact it was clear to their interlocutor that that's not what they were doing. Okay, so in other words, they actually said something that was clearly untrue. It was a lie, if you will, in order to move their halachic agenda. And the question is, why did they choose this modality? Why did they choose this approach? Wouldn't it have been more praiseworthy to say, okay, you're talking to a student. We're not even talking to Joe Ploni on the street. So speaking to a student, I said, listen, we have a halacha that you're allowed in this particular case to sharpen your knife on Yom Tov, but don't tell anyone. It's not something we want to let out, because we know that if we allow this particular case, people will also sharpen their knives in unpermissible ways on Yom Tov. Why didn't they say that? Yeah, Abaye and Rava, these were the greats of...
The students would have said that, and their students would have said that, and everybody would say that but everybody would know that it's that halacha, and then you have a problem, because people will do that.
Mm-hmm. Okay, in other words, you can't...
If you've got a secret, then you can't let people know that you have a secret.
Right, so that's the question. I think the question goes back to why keep the halacha secret? Just let people know you're allowed to do this, but we're worried about case number two, so we're going to tell you not to do it. In other words, don't do it. You should know, don't sharpen. I may have done it, but I'm telling you, you don't do it. I'm your rabbi, you're my student, I'm telling you, you're a great student, you're tremendous potential. Is sharpening a knife is the same as eating chocolate?
I don't know. I mean, the question is, what sort of a role am I teaching them? I'm doing something that...
What am I saying? What's the evaluation that Abaye and Rava are making? When they themselves are doing it, but telling their student not to do it. How does that translate? What does that mean? They're not saying, do as I say, do as I say, not as I do. What are they saying? Yeah.
Well, it seems like they're holding hostage the fear in general that the public would not know, they don't know the answer. Haredim and the Beirut is that you're protective of what the actual halakha is, and I think part of that is the fear that the masses won't know what
right, okay.
elevation involves. So, in other words, they have the knowledge, they know what to do, and they're scared that their students won't necessarily know, or that they'll go on and they'll be like a broken telephone.
Okay. In other words, they're saying I'm big enough that I can keep the secret, and you're not. Right? The student is not at this point in their life. I'm not giving you permission, as my student, to take on that role. That you're not big enough, right? Your position is not such that it's advantageous to our society for you to take on this role. You have to take on the role of the masses right now. The masses are not supposed to do it. So it. Presumably, and that's the truth. The way I understand the Gemara, that's essentially what they, if they were to say the truth to their student, that's what they would tell them. So the question is, why not simply tell them that? I mean, I think we're all, yeah, okay.
You don't need knowledge of power. You don't have the knowledge of the power.
So they're just looking out for their own personal power. Okay, I mean that's your opinion. It's my vision of the rabbis is not like that. I can't accept that. I mean, I'm not saying it's not valid. I'm saying I can't accept that personally.
No, I don't know about the rabbi, but like in general, who has the knowledge?
Knowledge is power. There's no question. The question again. Paternalism can be. If we're talking about strict paternalism, we're talking about someone who's doing something for the benefit of the other. As he's using that power for the benefit of the other person. I know that there's a stock that you won't buy that's going to make you a millionaire unless I pretend that there's information that I don't have that I really do. So I'm doing it for your own good, but I'm not telling you the truth. My vision of the rabbis. Is that's how they saw themselves. Not they weren't wielding information, keeping information for their own sake, as we saw in the Rambam also. Yeah.
It's not like a book for a student, but when we told them information, but I find it much more problematic to decide to withhold information not to act in the way in which you tell your community to act. Meaning, okay, you see, I tell you not to trust. Even in your, I think it's a very important as a leader, even in your home, when you're in Dalit Amot, if you decide it's dangerous to let out certain information, I think it's important, I find it very problematic that as a leader you will not hold the same standards vigorously.
Yeah, but don't forget, in this case, that would be true if they had given the information, but in fact they didn't give the information, right? So they failed in the strategy. They got caught. But assuming they didn't get caught, right? So then there's no danger in actually performing the act. They're worried about other people doing it. If they had said to their students, "We don't want people doing it, so you don't do it," so that would have been a different approach. In which case, you're right. It would have been. In my mind, completely derelict to say, okay, you don't do it, and then for them, you're right, a role model is necessary in that case. So that's not a strategy that they took. It's interesting, one could discuss why the Gemara illustrates their failure. But be that as it may, again, I gave you the license of time. I see we're still going to run out of time. The problem is the issue is fairly obvious that there's, again, ostensibly, certainly traditionally, there is a greater effectiveness, certainly among the masses, if you tell them that it is asur, and if you want them not to do something, right, you have no good reason to do it, it's going to be more effective to tell them it's forbidden than if you tell them it's permissible, please don't do it, right? Traditionally speaking, now we're going to speak about the current situation as a possible exception to that, right? The middle position, it has part of the weaknesses, part of the disadvantages of both situations. What you're saying is it's basically forbidden, but there are ways around it. you don't have the full force of the law behind you. You're weakening your position. So obviously you're able to maintain the integrity of truth, the truth of the system, but at the same time you're not maximizing compliance with your agenda, which again, the agenda, our assumption is that the agenda is for the benefit, or at least is viewed as being for the benefit of the people. I want to ask one more question. Actually, the truth is, this agenda, there's other issues that we really there are problems with it that we didn't discuss. There are some intrinsic problems, even classically. As even before we get to the period of time that we're currently in, even we get to the modern era, to the information age, there are certain problems, which I think, it's interesting, the Frimmers don't speak about effectiveness as mine. So they speak about intrinsic problems as if these problems were always around. Interestingly enough, though, the people they cite are all contemporary rabbis. So contemporary meaning the last 100, 200 years, if I'm not mistaken, you should check me on that. Look at footnote 231, is where they speak about some of the problems with this approach. They talk about discrediting the halakha, obviously. In other words, if you're caught saying something that's not true, that obviously has negative ramifications, right? You can explain that I did it for the benefit of the people, whatever it is, but it doesn't look good, right? In spite of the fact that anybody who knows the system realizes that this is, in fact, part of the system, and we do not necessarily tell the truth all the time. I mean, Tanakh itself. You don't have to go very fast, far in Tanakh to see the truth is not always the most important variable. Be that as it may, truth is all, being lied to is never something that people welcome, no matter what the reason. And therefore, it has negative ramifications. Again, in the classical system, people don't drop halakha as a result. But the seriousness with which they take the rabbi's words is obviously affected, right? In other words, last time he told me something that I really have to do. So therefore, this time also, when the rabbi says it's usually prohibited in this context, then you're also not going to take it with that seriousness and say, well, perhaps you also ultimately we're dealing with offense. On some level, this is really a major issue when there's secondary level halakha. What I mean by secondary level halakha, whether it's from it's Torah law, whether it's rabbinic law, I'm speaking about fences. Right? Even in the Torah, you have fences. Right? For example, the famous cases, which are very much at the core of this, right? The cases again with the Gemara speaks about in Sanhedrin with Shlomo HaMelech. Not to have too many wives. Why not? Lest they lead your heart astray. What's the problem? Is the problem the wives? Doesn't seem to be. Because then the point is, if the problem is the wives, there's no need to give what it's going to bring you to. Right? Don't marry foreign women. Why? Right? What's the reason given? They'll, remember, it's Torah. Chumash. They'll lead you to what? Abu Dazara, they'll lead you to the gods of their culture, right? So is marrying foreign women intrinsically a problem from that perspective? It's not, okay? And all the more so in the rabbinic arena, we have all sorts of things which are fences, meaning they themselves are intrinsically not problematic, right? That's a very difficult concept. I mean, again, the Gemara says you have the wisest person who fell for this. Right? Who's not able to keep secondary level halacha, feeling that ultimately it's not of intrinsic importance. So, a lot of, this is not, I mean, there are issues that are not necessarily tied to secondary level halacha in terms of trying to get people to do what they don't really have to do, but this is a major area. In any case, disadvantage of not telling people the truth are not only that you're weakening your authority if you get caught, right, but also weakens the fabric of halakha itself. In other words, most of halakha is not dealing with major, big M, meta-halachic issues. And we find out what halakha is based on rational analysis. Right? If someone throws a red herring into that analysis, it's thrown back in their face, as it should be. As someone says, but, you know, I like wool and linen together. It looks good. Right? So it's not a halachic argument. It's a joke. Right? There's no weight. Right? Or I think that it's come time for Jews to incorporate, right, Shabbatai Tzvi style, incorporate, right, Shabbos into our daily practice to bring it up to close, you know, to bring out the Kedusha latent, right, in such a mixture. Right? By the way, it's not as outrageous as it sounds, but be that as it may. I guess it's coming close to Purim, preparing early. But be that as it may, that is not part of, that's not a legitimate halachic position. And if you want the system to be a system of jurisprudence, of law, it has to be based on rational proof and rational discussion. Meta-halachic agendas, good or bad ones, right, threaten the fabric of the system. I think Rabbi Henkin writes in one of the notes, and he's not the first one, many others say it as well, that one has to be very, very sparing. And you see that the Gemara doesn't use this all the time, right? Distortion of information. You have to be very careful. There's a system, there's a legal system, and there are extra legal measures. There are measures that go beyond what's usually used within that system. And if you use it too much, then you destroy the system. There's no system left. What that means is the famous quote from Mordechai Kaplan, the founder of Reconstructionist Judaism, that halakha should have a vote but not a veto. That's what he said about his vision of halakha, is something that cannot be part of normative Judaism, in the sense that once you give it that power, and what is he saying? He's saying that ultimately the bottom line is ethics. Bottom line is ethics. If ethics aren't involved, right, then halakha can state its position. But if ethics are involved, then we'll consider what the halakha has to say. Right? If you make meta halakha the top tier, the main place you're going to go anytime you have a question, for example, vegetarianism. Right? If you're going to say, well, first we have to look, you know, the fact that halakha permits it, I have to put that aside. First I have to look at the ethics. Then I'll let the halakha play in. If every issue that you're going to come to is going to be extra halachic, then ultimately there's no voice nor veto to halakha. You don't only eliminate its veto, you also eliminate its vote or its predominant voice. You destroy, essentially what you do is you destroy the system that way. Anyways, I want to get back to one more question about this thing, and then speak about how contemporary reality affects the equation. I think it affects the equation greatly. We quoted the Meiri last week, based on Rav Lichtenstein's Bring It Down, his article. The Meiri says there are certain times when really important things have to be done. And as a result, I'll quote from his words. Remember, he was speaking about what the rabbis meant in Gemara and Sanhedrin, that the people in Sanhedrin had to be able to know the Taher et Hasharet min HaTorah. Right? So he explains that She'im Yehu Takalot Yotzot Bedot Ehem Be'ezid Din Torah. If they see problems coming out that are threatening laws of the Torah, Yitzu lachadesh dinim lehotzifi ligvoa lehorot sha'a. So they should, in fact, make new laws or take away laws temporarily based on the situation. What I want you to listen carefully to the next part. V'liten smach ledivreim in haTorah. And to give some sort of support to their words from the Torah. Okay? He continues and says, this is what the Gaonim did. לחדש גזירות ותקנות דרך כלל ודרך פרט להסיר איזה עניין מכוער. So they'll add or subtract different things, right, from הלכות, to remove some ugly thing, לפי מה שיראה בזמנו, according to what they see in his time, בסמך מועט. Again, this lashon of smach mu'at, with a very small amount of support. So what I want to ask you, I mean, what the Miri is saying, he's saying he's taking position somewhere between two approaches. He's saying going beyond where the normative halakha will take you. But no, he's not talking about giving you disinformation, or at least not telling you about making something up, as much as taking a very difficult, hard to believe interpretation of a verse. We recall that we spoke about in the Nefesh HaChayim, Lo B'Shamayim Hi, or even more potently, the Chatam Sofer, Chadash HaSumer HaTorah. In other words, there's a precedent. Finding a precedent is the Me'iri, right? Even though it's a very weak precedent. Right? So I want to ask you, does that help such an agenda? Is it better than an out and lie? Or is it ultimately the same thing? Right? And here he says, fine, they're allowed to find some sort of weak evidence to bolster their point. Like, going back to the Rosh Yeshiva at YU, maybe from that perspective it was heavy evidence, but perhaps this is exactly what they were doing. How does that strike you? Is it along the same lines as distorting information, or is it giving it some sort of redemption by giving some sort of evidence, even if the evidence is not out of conviction, but it's artificial evidence?
It's very dangerous.
You mean it's dangerous?
Yeah, because anybody can do it. Say, well, this pasuk in the Torah means that such.
So it's a bad example.
And that's look, the Torah did such and such halakha, so I can also change halakha to my will.
Yeah, I mean, perhaps that's why the Me'iri says this is reserved for the Muflagei Ador. For only the leaves. The question is doing that encouraging other people, like you said, to simply take a verse? In other words, I have this Tana against Parshanut Hasidi. Right? If you look at the Hasidic, I mean, there's tremendous things the Hasidic masters say, but as someone who's involved in Parshanut, I take great offense to the way they deal with Mikra. Because why do I take great offense? Because once you say basically anything about the Mikra, then the Mikra doesn't say anything anymore. It's devoid of meaning. It becomes simply words to attach anything you want to. Right? So what you're saying is essentially the Me'iri is suggesting a Parshanut Hilchati Hasidi, right, to bolster up credibility. Now, why is he doing it? Again, it's the same reasons that we're willing to make out and out lies in order to bolster the credibility. Again, a rabbi simply says, I don't like it, and it's asur. Right? We'll take back what the Chatam Sofer speaking about. I don't know if I said it clearly last week. He was worried people were putting the bimot, where you read the Torah, instead of the middle of the shul, which is a Ramah, but apparently the Ramah is Minhag, it's not so bind as a tshuva of Ramoshe, anybody wants to look it up, in Orech Chaim Chelek Bet, the Membet, Tshuva Membet, if you want to take a look, speaks about this issue also, about putting the Bima of the Beit Knesset in the front of the shul. That's what they wanted to do in Hungary, because that's apparently what the Reform Jews were doing. I guess it looks more like a church. It looks more orderly. It's better organized. Whatever it is, right? The Chatam Sofer says it's asur and gives all sorts of reasons for it, none of which are extremely strong halachically. So is it better? Rav Moshe says it's not an issue, as one is it. But is it better for the Chatam Sofer simply to say, I don't like it, don't do it? Or is it better for him to find reasons that are smach me'at? Right? Certainly in terms of the effectiveness, it's clear. Again, we're working on a spectrum. One end is truth, and classically. On one end is truth, on the other end is effectiveness. And the decision you have to make is how far away from truth are you willing to go in order to be effective. And presumably, it's clear that we don't do this all the time, presumably, what's going to be motivating a rabbi is how important is effectiveness in this particular situation. Classically, that's the equation. Classically, that's the equation. Obviously, you have to be clever. If you know you're going to be caught, or if there's large possibilities you're going to be caught, then you can't do it. And that brings us to the contemporary period, where I would argue that the effectiveness of lying is severely compromised for a variety of reasons. And I don't think it just starts in the information age in the last 20, 30 years. I think it starts from when the Torah Shebaal Peh is written down into being a written Gemara. When I was teaching Gemara, so I like using this particular story. When I was teaching the Gemara of Beitza to Bali Batim, the type of people you would want to keep this information away from, right, in the time of the Gemara, who you're supposed to keep it a secret from, right? The question of the knife, right? The question of the knife on Yom Tov, right? And it was the people were asking were actually students, but in the Gemara they were students. These people were also students, but traditionally these are the people that you're trying to manipulate. So what do I do? It's there. The Gemara is right there. So do I skip it? And what rabbi are we skipping this paragraph for? Right? It's written. It's there for all to see. That's already goes back almost 2,000 years, right? So that's already compromised then. But I think it's still tenable, because for most of Jewish history and most cultures, access to the Gemara is very limited. It's limited to an elite, right? So long as it's limited to an elite, you can keep the secret within the elite. Come along mass education, again, for whatever reason, and we're really speaking about the last 100 years, probably and possibly the last 30 to 40 years, where there is mass accessibility to the Talmud, right? That makes it much more difficult. It's a Talmud and Poskim and all these texts that we delve into, it makes it much more difficult to pretend something is true that's not, right? Moreover, in the last 10 years, the popularization, even the invention, not much before that, of the internet, making everything not only available, but available instantly at your fingertips, makes the keeping away of information very difficult. So these factors, the fact that the Torah Shebaal Peh is written down, the fact that people are educated and have access and understanding, not only can they pick up a Gemara or log on to a Gemara on the internet, people are able to understand it as well. Large numbers of people are able to understand it. So even if not everyone is, the masses, the dividing line between the elite and masses is blurred. So there's a lot of people in the middle. And how do you keep it away from this person and not the other person? Right? So all these things, I think, compromise the approach that if you really believe something to be incorrect, if you're a rabbi with an agenda, and you believe you have a legitimate and correct agenda, trying to give disinformation to advance your agenda is highly questionable in terms of its effectiveness. Again, I'm not judging its validity. I think classically it's certainly viewed as valid. Whether we agree with it or not, it's not really the issue. Certainly classical Judaism views it as valid. I shouldn't say certainly. It's my opinion, but I think that, again, the onus of proof would be on the person saying otherwise. Be that as it may, it's certainly not, I shouldn't say it. Certainly, in my opinion, I highly question the effectiveness of such an approach today. So if, there, for example, going back to the rabbis at YU who were against women's minyanim, according to the Frimer brothers, simply gave weak evidence that they themselves couldn't have possibly believed in, then I would suggest that their approach was not a correct approach. If that's in fact what happened, again, it's not at all clear that that's what happened. But again, from the perspective of this article, there's a couple other issues that compromise some of the other approaches. And as right now we're focusing on the most controversial, the most difficult possible way to bring out a meta-halachic agenda, and that was by disinformation. So with that, so there are two other approaches. One is by counsel, and the other one is by taking halakha as far as you see it will go based on your own understanding of the situation. Now, there's other issues in modernity that I think affect all three issues and affect any meta-halachic agenda that's put forward by rabbis. Number one, Rabbi Sperber mentions this as a factor as to why rabbis are much more timid today. Not timid personally, but timid in terms of presenting new halachic positions. Certainly far-reaching halachic positions. And that's the fact that anything that's written, more than that, anything that's even said, is subject to tremendous amount of critique. Meaning that, we speak of our times as the information age. It's so easy for information to go from one place to another, meaning that if you hear a psak, you read a psak that you don't like, right? If you're a feminist and you see the rabbis at YU giving a psak that you don't like, what are you going to do? Well, right away, the first thing you do, what are you going to do? If you want to do something about it. You can call another rabbi. Yeah, you can call another rabbi, right? And if you're really smart, you're not going to just call another rabbi. You've got a list of people, and you're going to ask them. You're going to post to your list, right? Your list of friends, the Jofa, whatever it is, right? And you're going to post, this is what these rabbis said. Do you know rabbis who say otherwise? And that's going to go, right? And the Frimer brothers or other people, or, you know, whoever it is going to say, what kind of argument is this? Right? So that it can work just as easily the other way. And it probably works even more the other way towards liberal positions. That was a conservative position that was fought. But if you take a liberal position, if you go out on a limb, right? If you have an agenda that's meta-halachic, it's very difficult to assert it in the halachic world that we exist in. Right? Because there's no central authority, not that there was much more central authority in the past, but what compromises, the fact there was no central authority was not as compromised because everybody had their little dalet amot. Every rabbi had their dalet amot that they could have jurisdiction over. A person didn't like the psak in Minsk, right? He wasn't going to post it onto his little discussion group. That was the decision. In which case, it could be written, and could be mulled over, and could be considered, and it could set a precedent. As opposed to today, anything that's not straight and narrow, for good and for bad, is automatically questioned and addressed and attacked and written over and written in all sorts of different permutations, such that it's very difficult to advance any meta-halachic agenda within halakha. Which ultimately leaves us with only one approach, which in itself also is compromised. As we said before, people automatically don't like being told what to do. That's part of our nature. But in a culture that treasures, that places personal autonomy as perhaps the highest value, that has an impact on religious Jews as well. Such that it's hard enough for us to accept rabbis who say, I have authority and I have knowledge that you don't. This is what you need to do. Right? That's hard enough. But if the rabbi says, I have knowledge but I don't have authority, it's very difficult for them to push their meta-halachic agenda as well, which creates an impasse. I hope you realize, I mean, this is only one area where this issue of personal autonomy confronts traditional religion in general, but traditional Judaism in particular, straight on. Such that between the technical realia that we live in, such that information is something that is our fingertips, certain agendas are really ineffective for rabbis. The only tool that's left to them is leadership and education, both of which are extremely compromised in a society that values personal autonomy. Rabbi Leshem was here a few weeks back, and he spoke about the Esh Kodesh, very much dealing with these issues about how to educate Jews to want to do Judaism when they're the ones who are going to decide about it. This ultimately becomes the problem. But it becomes a much bigger problem when we're talking about religious leadership, like communal leadership. It's hard enough simply to educate Jews to want to be Jewish and to do mitzvot and to make that decision, which ultimately they have to make on their own, seeing themselves as autonomous individuals. But it's even harder to try to shape, to try to mold Judaism, to try to mold and shape the Jewish people in the situation that we find ourselves in. So while meta-halachic agendas, we'll speak more on a different topic next week, the last topic, we didn't even start the Chaim Soloveitchik article, the various Mari Makomot that I put over there, there's a tshuva of Rav Adi Yosef, there's a tshuva of Diane Weiss. You should take a look at both of those tshuvot if you're able to, as well as the article. But just to summarize what we spoke about today, going back to the last two classes, though meta-halachic agendas are not only legitimate, but are essential on some level for the proper functioning of halacha, right, for the proper functioning of the Jewish religion, what avenue and how to advance such agendas have become very limited for all agendas, both the conservative agenda that we spoke about last week, as well as the more humanistic liberal agenda that Rabbi Sperber proposes. Both agendas are extremely stunted and extremely limited because of the various factors that we spoke about in the last few minutes.